Hello, I'm Gemma Birrell, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers' Festival. You're listening to a podcast about Napoleon, recorded live at the 2016 Festival. This discussion explores the intrigues of one of history's greatest public figures, as Philip Adams speaks with writers Philip Dwyer, Anne Whitehead and Tom Keneally, who've all written about Napoleon and share their particular perspectives.
Welcome to the Sydney Writers Festival. And I was just saying to Tom Keneally here how it doesn't feel quite right without Bob Ellis. Who was the most written about figure in human history? With a bit of impetus from Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, I suppose it has to be Jesus. Imagine all the books written about Jesus. Hitler, Abraham Lincoln gave him a bit of a shove more recently, but then it has to be Napoleon. 70,000 books written about him, now 70,003 about this bloke since his death in 1821. There'll be a fourth because I am writing one myself. And this is because I discovered some years ago why Keating is so obsessed with Napoleon. It's because he is his reincarnation. I was sitting at home looking at a doco on Napoleon, and up on the screen came a painting by Ingres, I hope that's how you pronounce it, with Napoleon in all his imperial bling. And I'm looking at it and I said, bloody hell, it's Keating. And, you know, but I approached it in the proper scholarly fashion and I asked Paul whether this was the case, and he neither confirmed nor denied. Napoleon Bonaparte, one-time emperor, ruled over 70 million people. He takes control of France in 1799 at the age of 30, following a coup of the Directory, the name given to the regime which had held power after the fall of Robespierre. It had taken him barely 3 years to rise from political obscurity to become the so-called saviour of France. And he did it by convincing the French, and this is a quote from Philip Dwyer, "Despair of relying on yourselves and rely only on me." I commend that line to Malcolm Turnbull. It's not as simple as its time, but it has a certain resonance. With me on the stage, Philip Dwyer, director of the Centre for the History of Violence at the University of Newcastle, biographer of Napoleon. His latest is called Citizen Emperor, Napoleon in Power, 1799 to 1815, and it's the second in his trilogy. Anne Whitehead, who was on the Little Wireless program last year, discussing Betsy and the Emperor. Anne is an award-winning historian. And my next guest, of course, is, we've plucked him from total obscurity, Tom Keneally, a Booker Prize winner for Schindler's List, among countless others. And his latest is Napoleon's Last Stand, a novel based on his time on the island of St. Helena. Now, it has been said, Tom, that Hitler and Stalin were genocidal ideologues, but Napoleon was only interested in personal glory. What do you reckon?
And you're asking, he certainly wasn't genocidal, and I don't think he should be compared to 20th century dictators. He was ambitious, he was ruthless, and he probably was what we might describe today a little bit of a sociopath, in that he didn't really care about how many men he lost in order to achieve his goals. And one of the prime examples of that is that after the disastrous Russian expedition, where he lost upwards of 600,000 men, he turned around immediately and tried to raise another 600,000 men, thinking that men were nothing more than a resource to use for his political purposes.
Tom, as a great storyteller, what is it about Napoleon that continues to so fascinate us? Why the 70,000 books?
Well, I think that Philip's book's title encapsulates the paradox of Napoleon, the citizen emperor, who virtually is, it's almost correct to say that he became emperor to save the Republic.
In some ways.
And so he was a Republican emperor. These contradictions are at the heart of the story and continue to fascinate. For example, Dame Mabel Brooks in Melbourne and her husband Sir Norman Brooks, they were as conservative as you can get. Dame Mabel was a descendant of Anne Whitehead's people, Anne Whitehead wrote about the Balcombes. But they went round the world collecting Napoleon memorabilia.
Very strange things in that collection.
Oh, yes, indeed. And, well, they were intimate with Napoleon during his time on St. Helena. No one goes around trying to buy Hitlerite or Stalinist furniture unless they've got odd taste. No one says, I want a bit more of that Hitlerite decor in my flat. But we all want furniture by Jakob Freer, plate by Sèvres. We all want the enamelware if we can afford it.
And we can take it to Keating for authentication.
Precisely, yes. So, and then the fact that he was a man of great personal charm. I don't think we dare use the word charm about Hitler and Napoleon, but I think Hitler must have had some, but you say so through gritted teeth. With Napoleon, it's exuberant, it's present, and it's there in Anne's book, and I hope in mine, when Napoleon plays Blind Man's Buff on St. Helena, this huge machine of destiny plays child's games with children on St. Helena.
And your love affair didn't begin with love. You didn't actually like Napoleon when you started writing your book, but you also became, well, seduced by his qualities.
Yeah. If you'd told me a dozen years ago that I was going to be absorbed with Napoleon for a long time, you could have knocked me over with a feather. But I came into him through wanting to follow up the story of this little girl who had ended up in Australia for 10 years, and whose father had been our first treasurer. And it was the impact of Napoleon for 3 years on the island of St. Helena that obviously was a sort of shadow over their lives. And so when I began researching, and I knew I had to explore what everybody on the island had written about Napoleon, and everybody used to dash away after talking to him and take down sort of what he, you know, it was like a literary colony. And when I began, I had the standard view that he was, you know, an incredible military commander, but a mass murderer. And I had a very, very negative view of him. But as I read more and more about him and the interaction of these people on this little island, and how he dealt with them, I became, yes, seduced by him because I find him fascinating. That he was not only one of the world's greatest military commanders ever, and I did go back and read Phillips' two wonderful books and many others, and he was an extraordinary military commander.
But he also had his valet pack 500 books from Jane Austen to Voltaire to take with him.
Exactly, and when he was rushed, you know, he had the Allies at his heels after Waterloo, and Blücher wanted him shot, but he made sure that 500 books were packed along with, you know, fine sets of porcelain.
I make the point that
he was an intellectual.
On these various reality television shows where people are dumped on a remote island, none of them take 500 books with them.
No.
How did you get embroiled? I know you're looking forward to the immediate future when you will finally escape Napoleon's gravitational
yes.
pull. How did you happen?
The story goes back a long time. I fled Australia, Perth, when I was a young man to go to France. And eventually ended up at the Sorbonne there. And one of my professors, Jean Toulard, was the preeminent specialist in the Napoleonic era at the time. And I sort of fell under his sway and stayed on to do higher studies there. And it went on from there. And when I started writing, you know, back in the early 90s, there was almost no serious English studies of Napoleon. Well, the last ones had been done in the 50s and 60s by a couple of Oxford dons. So I thought it was time to write something a little different. But I am looking forward to the day when I've already written the death scene, I'd just like to point out. And he dies a horrible pain.
Oh, don't spoil the story.
Yes. It was a very cathartic moment for me to write that scene because it was a kind of symbolic shedding of the man as well. He's kind of hung over me. It's like being in a bad marriage for 15 years and you're kind of stuck in it and you can't get out of it. But now the divorce is in sight and we're both looking forward to getting on with our respective lives.
They used to say in the 19th century, better a bad husband than no husband at all. So,
Tom, one of the things about Napoleon which reminds me very much of Paul Keating, do not dare to judge me like other men. I am a being apart. Now, this is when he was a young general.
Yes, sure.
Did he ever lose that innate self-confidence, even after mounting defeats?
He had a capacity to convince certainly the inhabitants of St. Helena and certainly any Whiggish visitor from the Royal Navy or from mainland Britain that he was still a man apart. At that stage of history, we hadn't seen where men apart, such as Hitler and Stalin, could take us, or even Keating, could take us. And therefore, the proposition of being a man apart was still intact for those. The Tories hated him. And the Tory, he had the misfortune to be on St. Helena under a high Tory administration made up of despicable human beings who make George Brandes look like the Christmas elf. These were Castlereagh and Bathurst. We named our rivers after monsters. And so he wasn't under a very genial administration, but those who had personal contact with him were, I think you could say, entirely enchanted. And that enchantment was the tragedy of the family you wrote about and that I've written about. We found out we're writing the same book halfway through. Both of us were too far in to give up. And we remained friends.
A gentleman would have stood aside, Tom.
Sadly, the patriarchy's golden days are shot. And I'm glad Anne didn't, because there are a number of great Australian novels lying in Anne's book. Because he got so close to Napoleon, he was punished. And ultimately, he was like a lot of the Australian, a lot of English gentry that were inconvenient. He was given a job in Australia. First colonial treasurer of New South Wales. Now, the story of that family in Australia, with the shadow of the dead Napoleon still living amongst them, still influencing them, still in the absolute crux of the mechanics between the family, that is a great story, particularly since he died in our first big depression. This is... The bloke who called... How can you dislike a bloke who calls his host on St. Helena... forgive my French, it's from the Gough Whitlam School of French. Cinq bottes. Five bottles. Five bottles Balcom, he called him. And five bottles Balcom died in our first depression in Australia. But, you know, even Napoleon at a remove is a phenomenal story. And it's there... Sorry, I've got to let the scholars talk. But it's there in that great novel by Stendhal, which I pretended to read for 40 years to have read. Oh, yeah, Stendhal and I are mates. But I last read it, and it's about the doerness of monarchical France after the fall of Napoleon, and a young man who is enslaved feels disinherited by the fall of Napoleon. And so the impact is almost universal.
Do not dare to judge me like other men. I am a being apart. This is a belief that we see in most of our prime ministers and in American presidents, none of whom admit to error, except perhaps Tony Abbott. I raise it because I want to ask you about this. Did Napoleon ever admit to catastrophic error, up to and including on his deathbed? For example, he takes an army of 600,000 to Moscow and only 93,000 survive.
I think 25,000.
Less, I think around 20,000 actually came back, straggled back across the Niemen. And no, he never admitted to any mistakes. He would always either, and Waterloo was the same, he'd always either blame other generals for not following out orders properly, or in the case of Russia, he would blame the weather, but it was always somebody else's fault for his.
And that's one of the reasons you found him so hard to like initially, his attitude to his men.
He's absolutely careless with human lives. Chateaubriand said of him, he is so careless with French blood because he doesn't have a drop of it himself. he was absolutely ruthless, and it was those campaigns and pushing onwards, pushing through Russia, pushing into Egypt with the intention of going on to India and capturing that prize from the British East India Company, was all about personal ambition, I would say, rather than for France. The French were tired of war. They'd had war, the Revolutionary Wars, since 1793, and they were exhausted. But Napoleon had this obsession that he must become not just the master of Europe, but the master of the world. And that egotism, that ambition, I agree with Philip, was there right to the end. But there was also a charm, as we were saying, and sometimes a delightful sense of humour. Even as he was dying in the last few days, when he made out his will, he knew there was a Frenchman who'd attempted to assassinate the Duke of Wellington. And so he included quite a large amount in his will for that man. Wellington had admired Napoleon enormously until then. He used to say, Napoleon is worth, even though he was his great adversary, Wellington actually said, Napoleon in battle is worth 40,000 men. But after he heard about that clause in the will, he lost his affection for him. Although he continued buying every relic of Napoleon after Napoleon's death that he could get hold of. It was, I guess, like people who go out and shoot a deer and want to have the head stuffed on their wall. He wanted all these trophies of the man he'd defeated.
This is the Sydney Writers' Festival, and we're chatting about Napoleon with Anne Whitehead, with Tom Keneally, and with Philip Dwyer. Philip, why were people so willing to follow him off the cliff? What was it? Is it simply that they bought this line, despair of relying on yourselves and rely only on me?
Probably not. I just want to follow on from what Anne said. There's also a little line in the will where he legged his doctor 20 francs so that he could go out and buy a rope with which to hang himself. He hated his... So this kind of black humour right to the last. Why people followed him? This is an interesting thing about men, soldiers and glory that... In our age, we probably find difficult to understand, but men, and you can read letters of soldiers to their girlfriends about him, for example, where they say that they love Napoleon and that they would follow him. So there's a kind of bond there between the men and the leader that you wouldn't find in today's armies, and partly it's because he brought them so much glory, not only as individuals, but as a nation. And glory, or gloire as the French would call it, of course, was a notion that they embedded with an extraordinary amount of importance. So this is one of the reasons why I think they're prepared to follow him. And what they lacked, as Tom was saying, after he left, There's a nostalgia in France because it's so peaceful from about 1815 right through to the second Napoleon comes along. There's almost no war to speak of. What they missed most of all was that aspect of glory attached to the nation.
Well, there's a neo-Maoist movement in China. There are still plenty of people in what was the Soviet Union who think of Uncle Joe with warm approval, and I suspect there's quite a few people in Europe who remain fond of Hitler.
Don't forget he spread the code Napoleon, which was... and it would be accurate to say, would it, Philip, that he was an enemy of feudalism?
Only up to a point. He's the consummate politician. So where in some regions in southern Germany, for example, it was too hard to fight the feudal system, he'd accommodate it. So the Code Napoleon was a very flexible tool that...
I'm sorry, explain the Code Napoleon.
So this is a body of uniform laws. You have to understand that before the revolution, France was made up of all sorts of customs and traditions and laws. I mean, just a myriad of different kinds of legal systems. And the revolution brought about a kind of uniformity. And they started working on this uniform legal code before Napoleon came along. But Napoleon was the person that actually carried it right through to the end and enacted it. And then he started importing it to other countries that they had conquered as part of the empire. But he would accommodate parts of the code depending on where they were. So divorce in Italy was not going to pass, for example, secular divorce. So that was sort of cut out in the Italian version of the code, and so on and so on. But it was a kind of uniformizing tool that the French used to try and drag the rest of Europe into the modern era. And they dragged it kicking and screaming for the most part.
I sort of half remember his attention to detail. Didn't he also suggest that there was only a limited number of prenoms that could be used by French parents?
I don't know. I had heard that there's a sort of a list in the town halls of names that you can call your children to avoid parents calling their children, you know, Sunshine Rainbow. It doesn't happen in France. So there's a set list of names, but that becomes more complicated when you have a multicultural society.
And tell us the essence of the story on St. Helena, where he befriends this fascinating young woman.
Yes, and that's a story. This fascinating young woman was 13, Betsy, when he arrived, and her father was a merchant. And when he arrived, the governor had 4 days' notice and thought, God, where do I put this monster of Europe? The whole island was having a nervous collective breakdown. And he thought the only place he could put him that would be remote enough was up the top Longwood House, up on a plateau at the top of the island, and it's hit by the southeast trade winds. But it was used as a cattle barn at that time, and it wasn't ready. It had manure, it had rats. And so he thought he'd leave him in a boarding house in town. And Napoleon was furious about that because there was no garden, there was no courtyard, and every time he passed a window, the locals would wave at him. And so on his first day on the island, the first full day, the governor and the admiral took him on a ride up to see this Longwood House that was in disrepair but which would become his. And as he rode up, and this is a discovery that I think I've made that no one else has, because they've written about his relations with this family as a charming, delightful romp. But I believe from the letters of Marchand, his valet, that Napoleon, as he rode up, looked across the valley at this house where the Balcombe family lived and said, I'd like to live there. I'd like to live in that little summer house. There was a little one-room summer house. And on the ride back, he met that family. He met that cheeky 13-year-old, Betsy. Now, William Balcombe, the merchant, was always happy to make money. He was a very canny fellow. And he would have been very happy to rent the whole house, which had about 5 bedrooms and could have accommodated Napoleon, his key courtiers. But he insisted, no, I'm very happy to stay just in this little one-room pavilion. And what that meant was he had interaction with that family, and it turned out to be for 2 months until Longwood was ready. Now, why I believe he wanted that interaction was that on the ship coming out, and there were many officers and crew on the ship who would have been to St. Helena many times, there was a widespread rumour. I've found evidence that the rumour went back 7 years before Napoleon came to the island, that William Balcombe, this merchant, was the illegitimate son of the Prince Regent. That's never been proved one way or the other. The prince, who later became George IV, would have had to have been 15 when he sired Balcombe. However, we do know...
Not technically impossible.
Not technically impossible, and certainly not with this character, the prince, because it was known that he was having it on with at least 3 women when he was 15. Anyway, whether Balcombe was or not the illegitimate child of him, what was certain, and that Napoleon would very soon have learned, was that the prince's very close friend, a man called Sir Thomas Tyrwhitt, that's spelled Tyrwhitt, but in that confusing way British have with pronunciations like Cholmondeley,
like Chumley. The shirt maker.
Yes.
Nobody's on the ABC, sorry.
Well, Sir Thomas Tyrwhitt was private secretary to the prince for 26 years and very close friend.
So to bring this together, he could see a strategic or tactical advantage.
Absolutely, because he may well, by mixing with the Balcombes, have had a connection through to the centre of power in Britain.
Tom, what do you reckon?
Yeah, I think that's... sadly, I only read that in Anne's book after mine was written. Otherwise, I would have plundered it. But I think that makes great sense, except that the Balcombes' power over the royal family always seemed very much at a remove, didn't it? William Balcombe's influence seemed very much at a remove, though Sir Thomas Tyrwhitt sort of looked after them when they returned to England.
He was at a remove supervised from the prince. Them. I mean, if the prince had fathered him, he wouldn't have wanted that put about, although he'd fathered other children. But Sir Thomas Tyrwhitt certainly was not at a remove. He, after the family had lived with Napoleon and played whist with him, and I believe Napoleon did genuinely become fond of this cheeky, mischievous hoyden of a girl, Betsy, who was entrancingly pretty, which helps.
And this then leads on, and we haven't got time to deal with it, to remarkable Australian connections down the track. So I commend you, people here today, and to the listener, that you grab hold of both books, that Anne's and also Tom's. I'm going to open this to questions from the audience shortly, but back to a very serious question to you, Philip. You argue that Napoleon was, in fact, despite his absolute self-conviction that he was godlike, that he was, in fact, simply a front man for powerful forces.
Do I? when he came to power, yes, in 1799, but as with the Weimar leaders thinking that they were using Hitler in order to be able to gain control of power, so did a number of men in France in 1799 think that they were using Napoleon to gain power. But once he got into that position, then he usurped it for himself and then ran off with it in all sorts of directions that were completely unexpected. He certainly, when he is in power, he's a front man for no one. He's his own man. He's surrounded by advisors, but he, and like any good leader, will take advice, but he always acted on it. And once he made a decision, that was it. There was no coming back. And he often made decisions against the advice of some of his entourage. The invasion of Russia, again, was one of those things where a surprising number of people said, yeah, I don't think that's such a good idea. But he nevertheless went off and did it.
On St. Helena, Betsy gave him a free critique of the Russian campaign, didn't she?
She did. He asked her the capitals of Russia, of France and so on, and she said Moscow, and he said... The French burned it, didn't they? And she said, no, they didn't. The Russians burned it to get rid of you. And he'd always been surrounded in France by docile young girls, and he'd never met anyone like this.
In a way, the one docile woman in his life, well, she wasn't docile at all, Josephine. You know, they had a wonderfully sort of abrasive, passionate relationship. He obviously liked women with a bit of cheek.
Up to a point. He said to Josephine, you must always remember that I am a man apart. There is no one like me. You must listen to me. He was mad about Josephine early in the relationship, and some of his love letters to her, some of the most romantic, erotic love letters one could know. Later, he cooled, he had affairs all over the place, it was later on St. Helena that he said to one of his courtiers, no, I don't think I have room to have love. I don't think I've ever loved a woman, or perhaps Josephine a little at the beginning. I don't think he loved women. I think he liked sex, but he got it over pretty quickly. As you say, his sexual congress was about as short as his dinners, which was about 15 minutes. Mm.
Oh, look, this is a family program, do we? Absolutely uncalled for. There are so many stories. There's one which I really love, where it is said that Joseph Banks snuck a kangaroo into Napoleon's possession, which hopped around Malmaison for a while. Can you... Paul Keating says it is the case. He remembers it distinctly.
It is.
But
yes, I believe is it
true?
I think it is true, but I can't.
Also... Baudin found a rare Australian tree called the perfume tree, Calameria antheroides, took it back to France or sent it back on his ship. He died before he got back to France. Sent it back to France. It was in Malmaison, and because of Napoleon's lusty relationship with Josephine, this Australian plant was believed to be an aphrodisiac, and it was planted... It was.
I'm sorry, what's the name of this tree?
Calameria anthera, the perfume tree.
Everyone here is furiously writing notes.
See you up at Mount Toma this weekend. And that is another Australian connection, along with the fact that Baudin named Victoria Terre Napoleon.
Josephine was very interested in Australian flora and fauna, and as well as the kangaroo, two black swans were taken over for the Malmaison garden. And if you can imagine what it must have been like, I mean, there were a number of birds from time to time taken over for different people. But if you imagine keeping two black swans alive and away from the ship's dogs on the quarter deck for that long voyage, and when they got to the lake at Malmaison and swam around happily for a while, Napoleon, in one of his rows with Josephine, took a pot shot at the swan and killed it.
This is the Sydney Writers' Festival, and it's doubling as an edition of Late Night Live, and my guests are Philip Dwyer, Anne Whitehead and Tom Keneally. I'm now going to open it for questions and comments from the audience, and if you'd put your hands up, Gar Basaria or Stan Corry, two of my beloved colleagues, will bring a microphone to you. Sir.
Thanks, Philip. I would like to ask the three writers what they think the most significant ongoing influences and ongoing lessons there are for modern French life and modern Australian life from the life of Napoleon. Thanks.
Don't invade other countries.
I think what it shows is that you take an individual who is extraordinarily talented in so many directions, who is intellectually brilliant, who's a strategic commander, who has charm, who has so many qualities, and you give him great power, and it is the absolute proof of Lord Acton's maxim that absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Tom?
I think it is that there are no men apart. The idea that a man can think of himself as a man apart is a warrant for all sorts of misbehaviour, including on St. Helena with the divine, chubby Countess Albine de Montholon. So, but worse still, in invasions of Russia. So, yeah, there are no men apart.
There's, yes. Sir, front row.
We've talked a lot about Napoleon's military successes. What are his other achievements, non-militarily?
Tom?
Philip is the...
They often, look, administratively, France is still shaped by the Napoleonic legacy. So they often talk about the institutions that Napoleon left behind, from the Council of State to the prefecture to the ways that the legal system is shaped to the Bank of France and so on. All of these are institutional structures that are that defined the modern France and in some ways defined many parts of modern Europe. So that in itself is an extraordinary legacy to leave behind. But you have to weigh that up with the enormous amount of pain and suffering that occurred at the same time. You could argue, as do a number of right-wing historians, that all of those reforms would have occurred anyway. Eventually, it just would have taken a great deal longer to have achieved. There was no need for the revolution and for Napoleon to have even taken place. I don't necessarily agree with them, but I don't know if those institutional structures do outweigh the pain and suffering that occurred during his lifetime. We don't know how many people are actually killed during the Napoleonic Wars. We know that there are about 1 million French soldiers that were killed, because someone went and actually counted in the archives how many were killed. And estimates about the number of civilians that were killed range between 700,000 and up to 4 million people. And those rates are comparable to the losses during the First and Second World Wars, in other words, per capita. So the wars had a tremendously traumatic impact on Europe in ways that we're only just really beginning to appreciate now.
Philip, can he claim credit for the ongoing legal system in France? Many Australian lawyers, no, not many, but a couple of very intelligent Australian lawyers believe that our adversarial court system is hopeless and doesn't lead to justice, whereas the French system does.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily agree with that, but certainly, I mean, a number of reforms of the legal codes have taken place in the course of the 19th and the 20th century, but the basis, the fundamental basis, remains Napoleonic.
Sir?
In this discussion, the linking of Napoleon, Hitler and Stalin has come up a couple of times. Would anyone like to comment on the fact that each of them is essentially an outsider? One's a Corsican, one's a Georgian, and one's an Austrian. Do you think that has that outsider coming to power in a somewhat different environment has anything to do with the way in which subsequent history unfolds?
That's a terrific question. Tom, you go.
Yeah, I think that sort of marginalisation is fuel to a talented, narcissistic character. I don't know about the role of mothers either, but Madame Mère, they used to call her, Napoleon's mother, who was still alive while he was on St. Helena. She was a powerful mother figure too. And of course, Stalin had this mother who was beaten up by a drunken father, but was also a very powerful figure in his life. So these elements in a life, it's remarkable how many really great novels are written by people who come from the margins, who are marginalized in some way, who feel they're not quite legitimate in their political community or their cultural community and have to prove they are. And same with political leaders, I think.
Anne?
Yes, I'd agree with that. When he was at the military academy and he'd come from Corsica had been taken over by France, but he still had a very thick Corsican accent at that time, and his spelling of his name was Corsican. And he was a skinny little chap, and he was rather mocked by some of the other French officers. And in fact, when he got a new pair of boots and they were too big for him, one of his girlfriends, who was later Madame Junot, mocked him and called him Puss in Boots, which was a fairy tale. But he could not stand that personal humiliation, that sense of egotism of achievement. I agree, yes, was thrusting forward from a background which was bourgeois, but was not aristocratic. And he was allowing, when he did become first consul, to allow the aristocrats back and to take positions of power, but never power beyond him. He was creating a republic which was totally imperial, and that was, of course, when he crowned himself emperor, that was fully achieved.
Philip, Napoleon as an outsider?
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I hate making comparisons between Napoleon, Hitler and Stalin, but all three characters come from the margins. All three characters are outsiders who somehow impose themselves upon the centre. And I don't know why, whether this is simply a coincidence or whether there is something that is driving these men from within to become accepted by powers that are greater than them, so to speak. But it's an interesting phenomenon, and there's a really interesting article in the American Historical Review about Hitler and Stalin coming from the outsides, sort of the margins of empire, to take control of it. But Napoleon too is a completely marginal figure and would never have been able to, of course, do what he achieved without the revolution, which we shouldn't, of course, forget.
And conversely, of course, George W. Bush got on very well with his mother. I don't know what that proves, but...
Well, I got on very well with mine, but I've managed not to invade Russia yet. If I do...
You were tempted, though, weren't you?
I'd go early in the spring.
Do we have a question from a woman, please? I've got to watch the gender balance. There's a new boss at the ABC. Thank you.
Okay. Each of you has really looked into the psyche of the man. And I'm wondering...
I'm sorry, you were just overwhelmed by an external sound.
I'll
go away.
I'll speak louder. Each of you have really looked into the psyche of the man, and I'd really love to know what you see as the greatest contradiction in that person.
Well, there's a scene on St. Helena where the beautiful, the charming Mrs. Balcombe, who is youngish, a mother of five children, rides out with Napoleon and a visiting officer's wife, and they encounter a string of Chinese coolies and slaves bringing up goods from the port of Jamestown. Now, this is very steep country, isn't it? So Mrs. Balcombe signals to the slaves to move off the track where they are and to detour around the track with their loads. And Napoleon, the emperor, says, "Madame, madame, no, please." And he rides his horse to the side and says to her, "Consider the burden." I find that a great contradiction in his nature and also very charming.
Well, charming up to a point. yes, there is a record he said that. And there's also a record, there was an old Malay slave that the Balcombes had, old Toby. There's a story well recorded by about three of the people on the island that Napoleon said, "Poor old Toby, I should buy his freedom and let him go back." And so this is the same sort of sentimental story as the other one. And Sir Hudson Lowe, the strict governor that Tom hates, and I don't like either, forbade the purchase of old Toby, so he couldn't go back. Now, that's a lovely sentimental story. Against that, the slave rebellion in what we now call Haiti, the island, led by Toussaint Louverture, was brutally suppressed by Napoleon's troops at Napoleon's strict orders when he was first consul. And Toussaint Louverture, a great hero to all oppressed people everywhere at that time, was taken to prison in the mountains of Jura on the border with Switzerland, where he died a miserable death.
Philip?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, and I'm sort of racking my brain thinking, what is it about Napoleon that's... I mean, there are lots of probably contradictions. He's a very complex character, and it may seem a little odd to say this, but I don't think... I mean, everyone talks about Napoleon's ambition because he conquered Europe and so on, but I don't think he was ambitious in that way. There is a sort of lack of ambition in Napoleon. Now, having said that, Napoleon did what he did because he was who he was, which, you know, is a fairly self-evident thing to say. But there's something driving him to do these things, but it's not what I would call or what we would recognise as ambition.
Another question from... Yes.
This is a question for Anne. What sort of long shadow did Napoleon cast over Betsy's life? She was 13, very impressionable when she met him, and 17 when she left St. Helena, which by then was marriageable age. Did she make a good marriage?
Indeed, it was marriageable age. Napoleon's own mother had married at the age of 14, and Betsy was very, very pretty, and I think Napoleon did probably fancy her, but he behaved himself. It was politically strategic for him to behave himself. He was still legally, in the eyes of the church, married to the daughter of the Emperor of Austria. Any sort of rumour about sexual misbehaviour would not have gone down well. I mean, he thought politically all the time. But I'm sure he was attracted to Betsy, but she was not, I would say, attracted to him in any way sexually, but I think he was the most magnetic, compelling, extraordinary character that she, in her young age, had ever met. And I don't think she ever met anybody like him. Her life afterwards...
Well, she never met another Napoleon. Poor child.
She married a cad, not because after Napoleon's death, I don't necessarily say they're connected, but she made a foolish marriage which rebounded badly on her, because men in those days could own everything a wife, and even if they deserted her, as this man did desert her with a child. The final third of my book, by the way, is set in Australia. Only the first third is set on St. Helena. Betsy referred again and again to her relationship with Napoleon. Later, when she was quite poor, she wrote a book, My Recollections of Napoleon on the Island of St. Helena, to make some money in the hope that her daughter could make a marriage that was not going to leave her in poverty the way Betsy had been. But the whole family did have a shadow over them when they left the island in disgrace, her father suspected of smuggling correspondence for Napoleon. That suspicion, once they arrived in England, was proved to be true, and this was potentially a treason charge. Balcombe could have been hanged and narrowly escaped because of his patron.
Philip, before I take another question from the floor, what was Napoleon's attitude to religion?
Practical. He brought up as a Catholic, of course, imbued with the Catholic faith, wasn't particularly a practicing Catholic, but
repeating all over again.
Yep. But realised the enormous influence of the church and wanted to restore the place of religion in France after France had gone through an incredibly tortuous revolution, in part because of a split between the church and the state. So he was trying to patch up that rift between church and state, if you like, in his own time.
The next but one from
that,
the floor.
That said, of course, it didn't stop.
Gail, that, the back there, thank you.
Thank you very much for a fascinating session. My question is related to the power structure that Napoleon would have had in place in Paris whilst he was away on lengthy campaigns. I understand his brother played a particular role, but also I'd like to know, apart from understanding more about who these individuals were and their relationships with Napoleon, in particular, what was his relationship with the media at that time as it existed? Be it pamphlets, be it nascent newspapers, how did he use media?
He controlled it. A very strict censorship regime. There were, when he came to power, about 70 newspapers in Paris alone. Within a few years, they were reduced to four, all controlled by the states. When Napoleon was away, he still controlled the structures of power. There are stories of him, and you can read them, of course, in his correspondence, of him while he's on campaign in Russia and even in Moscow, writing back to France letters detailing, how a girls' school should be structured. So a complete control freak in today's terms, had to have a say in everything that was done by the state, and everything emanated from him. And this is why the empire collapsed so quickly after he fell from power. There's no sort of structure to replace him. There's no sort of structure to keep the empire going.
Do you have a Peter Credlin?
No.
He hardly needed a Peter Credlin, did he? Because he did so much himself. I mean,
yeah, but what about when he's away losing the war in Russia?
He was sending dispatches. I mean, it said that on the eve of the Battle of Borodino, I think you have this, Philip, he dictated 60 letters to be sent off for how things should be governed in France. On the eve of the Battle of Erfurt, he was sending letters about the marriage of his one of his favourite marshals, Bertrand. His output in control was prodigious. Mm.
Okay, another question from the floor.
Talking of Napoleon's relations with the ancient regime, with the aristocrats, would you like to comment on his relationship with Prince Talleyrand, as his foreign minister and in other respects?
Napoleon, when he came to power, especially when he instituted a new form of monarchy, which was the empire, did his very best to accommodate the former nobility. And many of his courtiers were former nobles. So again, this was an attempt to patch up the rifts that had occurred, social and political rifts that occurred during the revolution. Napoleon was the unifying power. And as a result, attracted to him as many of the former nobles as he could. The Talleyrands were one of the oldest noble families in France at the time. And Charles Maurice, as many of you may know, was also a political operator that managed to survive just about every regime that had gone through the revolution. He started out as a bishop in Ancien Régime France and ended up as foreign minister under the Directory and continued as foreign minister under Napoleon. But Talleyrand was one of these interesting characters that sort of saw the writing on the wall quite early. So by 1806, 1807, he had come out against Napoleon's incredibly aggressive foreign policy and his constant warring, and then began to betray him behind his back by corresponding with some of the Eastern European sovereigns, and in particular Alexander I. And I think Napoleon realised this. So this is this famous scene where at the Tuileries Palace in Paris, Napoleon explodes and calls him shit in a silk stocking. And Talleyrand, because he's an Ancien Régime noble, is immovable. There's no expression, there's no kind of retort. He just went outside and commented to someone that Napoleon had terrible manners, and it's not something that you should say to anyone. But a complex relationship where Napoleon sort of realised that he was being betrayed, but and yet couldn't manage to do without him at the same time.
A final question, if you please. Microphone is being passed and accepted.
Did he take his 500 books to St. Helena, and what did Napoleon read? We are at the Writers' Festival, at least here.
What did he read on St. Helena?
What did he read? An extraordinary wide range of books.
Jane Austen, Voltaire,
Rousseau. He's English, so Jane Austen, we know that one of the people with him, one of the aristocrats with him, Madame Bertrand, had Jane Austen's Sense and Sensibility, and she would have, at that stage, translated it, read it to him in French. But later, Napoleon's reading in English became quite good. His spoken English was always pretty appalling. But he could read. He always demanded all the British newspapers. And he read Northanger Abbey. But he read Rousseau, he read Voltaire, he read histories, he read geographies, books about
Egypt.
And
if he was alive today, he'd be reading the three of you. It's time to wrap the session up. Terrific questions, incidentally. Thanks a lot for that. Good on you, Philip Dwyer. This is our second conversation. I look forward to a third when the final part of your history is published. The latest Citizen Emperor, Napoleon in Power, 1799 to 1815. Anne Whitehead, author of Betsy and the Emperor. And Tom Keneally, his latest Napoleon's Last Island, a novel based on his time on that Guantanamo organised by the British. That's all from Late Night Live here at the Sydney Writers' Festival. Thank you very much, panel. Thank you very much, audience. Time for the news on Radio National.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from Sydney Writers' Festival. You can find a range of other talks, interviews and discussions on our iTunes channel. And for more information about the festival, subscribe to our email newsletter through our website.